past few years, I've really looked forward to coming over here every summer. And if you fail to invite me one summer, I'll look really mean at all of you next time I see you after that. It's good to be with you tonight. I've done a little bit of traveling of late. I was in Russia 6 weeks ago today, my fifth trip over there. And we go about 200 miles south of Moscow to a town named Orel. I don't know if any of you have seen the Chernobyl miniseries that's been getting a lot of publicity of late. I didn't realize any of this, but the heaviest radiation from that explosion was 750 miles in any direction. And so when I learned that, I got out a map and found that Orel, where I go, is about 300 miles away. Now, the good news is I no longer need a nightlight because I am a nightlight now, but I'm not anticipating any problems from that. Be turning back to Exodus chapter 14. We're going to talk about the Lord's victory over the Egyptians at the Red Sea. I don't know if you realize this, but in your series this summer about the Lord's victories, we're starting at the top. There is no other victory in all of the Old Testament, by the testimony of the Old Testament, that comes close to what happens in Exodus chapter 14. In fact, the overthrow of Pharaoh's army is the Old Testament parallel to the New Testament resurrection. They're spoken of in the same sort of terms. Both were impossible events that were brought about by divine intervention. Both were great demonstrations, the greatest demonstrations of divine power in each testament. In Luke chapter 9, when Christ atop a mountain is talking to the leader of the Israelite Exodus, Moses, he makes reference to what's going to happen to him at Jerusalem, and he uses the word Exodus. Now, in our English translations, he spoke of his decease, which he would accomplish at Jerusalem, but the word translated decease there is the word Exodus. In both events, the Exodus and the resurrection, were especially memorialized by God, one with a weekly celebration, one with a yearly celebration. So there is no demonstration of divine power that exceeds the Exodus in the Old Testament. And to make it so, God had to stack the deck. That's something to understand about the Exodus. God was stacking the deck. Now I'm going to read from Numbers chapter 33, where Moses goes over the events that occurred when they left Egypt, starting with verse 3 of Numbers 33. Moses says, they departed from Ramses in the first month, on the 15th day of the first month, on the day after the Passover. The children of Israel went out with boldness in the sight of all the Egyptians, for the Egyptians were burying all their firstborn, whom the Lord had killed among them. Also on their gods the Lord had executed judgment. Then the children of Israel moved from Ramses and camped at Succoth. They departed from Succoth and camped at Etham, which is on the edge of the wilderness. So far, so good. They've moved from the interior of Egypt to the border of Egypt. They're up there in the northeast corner of Egypt. It's open road from where they are there on the edge of the wilderness to Canaan. I mean, it's a straight shot like the crow flies. They can see the promised land on the horizon. In less than 2 weeks, that entire group of Israelites could have moved from Egypt into the promised land. But in verse 7 comes a remarkable change of direction that God gives them. They move from Etham and turn back to Pi-Hahiroth, which is east of Baal Zephon, and they camp near Migdol, and you keep reading and you find out that from being on the very edge of Egypt with Canaan in front of them, God has them make a U-turn, do a 180, go back down into Egypt, and camp on the west side of the Red Sea. Now, why did God do that? Because getting Israel out of Egypt by just having them walk straight to Canaan was too easy. there were some lessons that needed to be taught several groups, but it was just too easy. So God puts them where they have an immovable object in front of them, the Red Sea. But he needed an irresistible force. And what better force than the greatest military power of that day, the mechanized cavalry and chariots of Pharaoh. Now, the Egyptians have been burying their dead, but look at Exodus 14, verses 3 through 6. God says something about the Egyptians. He says, "For Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, 'They are bewildered by the land, the wilderness has closed them in.' Then I will harden Pharaoh's heart so that he will pursue them, and I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord." And they did so. Now it was told the king of Egypt that the people had fled, and the heart of Pharaoh and his servants were turned against the people, and they said, "Why have we done this? Why have we let Israel go from serving us?" So he made ready his chariot and took his people with him. Also he took 600 choice chariots and all the chariots of Egypt with captains over every one of them. He's got his irresistible force. Now, unbelievers don't glorify God voluntarily. But God is going to get the Egyptians to glorify him. God says, "I'm going to make the Egyptian, I'm going to make Pharaoh so mad at me that he'll end up doing exactly what I want him to do." Look at verse 17 and 18. "And I indeed will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they shall follow them. So I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, his chariots and his horsemen. Then the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord." Moses goes down to Egypt and says, "Let my people go." Jehovah says, "Let my people go." Pharaoh says, "Who is Jehovah that I should let him go?" Moses says, "You're about to find out." And so God stacked the deck. He put Israel not in an improbable situation, but in an impossible situation. Immovable object in front of them, the Red Sea. Irresistible force behind them, the Egyptian army. And God says, "Now get ready to see what I'm about to do." God does this all the time. Gideon shows up with 32,000 men. God says, "That's way too many. If I let you defeat the Midianites with 32,000, you're going to claim credit for it. That ain't going to happen. So let's pare you down to about 300, 100 of your force of men carrying nothing but a flashlight and a vase, a bowl. And with that, I'll deliver you from Midian." Elijah challenges the prophets of Baal to a contest atop Mount Carmel, the battle of the gods. And they go up there, and Elijah says, "The God that answers by fire, let him be God." And all the people agree with that. And the prophets of Baal build their altar, and they spend half the day crying out. Now, it hadn't rained in 3.5 years. And they've got those flint knives out there, cutting on themselves, sparking. Just a single spark, it was so dry, would have sent up the sacrifice of Baal, but that didn't happen. And then it's Elijah's turn. And what does he do? He has 12 barrels of water brought up from the Mediterranean to completely soak that sacrifice. God continually was stacking the deck, giving the enemy every advantage, leaving no advantage to himself, and yet coming out victorious every time, all for the glory of God. That Egypt will honor me. That they will know who's God. So, in Exodus 14, we have the story of the overthrow of the Egyptian army. In Exodus 15, we have a song praising God for the overthrow of the Egyptian army. Don't skip over Exodus 15. It's the first song in the Bible. The first song that is sung in worship to God in the Bible was written about the overthrow of Pharaoh's army. And it wasn't a gleeful song. It wasn't a song of gloating. God wasn't dancing on the graves of the Egyptians. God hates it whenever a sinner dies. But it's a song that does glorify God, not so much literally as in symbols. A lot of people don't like the symbolic parts of the Bible. And Revelation, the book of Revelation is ignored typically for that reason. Too symbolic, too figurative. We want something literal. Well, folks, there are times when literal just doesn't work. There are some realities, some great truths for which we have no literal vocabulary. Describe for me a spirit being. What adjectives are you going to use to describe how a spirit being moves? How they look? How they act? And so in Exodus 14, I read that the way God parted the Red Sea was by a strong east wind, probably a sirocco. But there had never been a wind like that. A wind that can not only part the sea, but hold it back and dry off the ground. There had never been a wind like that. But we get to Exodus 15. And in Exodus 15, in symbolic figurative language, the writer says, God parted the sea with a blast of his nostrils. I like that better. I like to think of God just snorting and the sea parting. And so there's great value in reading Exodus 15. So we've got the story in 14, we've got the song in 15. But in Hebrews 11, we've got the synopsis. I'm going to ask you to turn to Hebrews 11. This is where we're going to be for most of our time this evening. This is the great chapter of faith, of course. And the singular thing to note about verse 29, which reads, verse 29, by faith they passed through the Red Sea as by dry land, whereas the Egyptians attempting to do so were drowned. The thing to note about verse 29 is that this is the first group reference in Hebrews 11. Up to this point, it's been individuals and their faith, individuals, that has been described and discussed. But for the first time, we've got a group that acted by faith being mentioned. And I want to break verse 29 and the immediate context down into three considerations tonight. We're going to look at the three principal figures involved in the events there at the Red Sea. And so I want to talk about God and the undeniable fact. And I want to talk about Israel and the unremarkable faith. And then talk about Egypt, the unbeatable foe. So God and Israel and Egypt. Let's talk about God first, the undeniable fact. First thing I want to say is there is no greater insult to God than idolatry. I mean, that's the ultimate insult. My Bible says the first temptation a man was ever confronted with was that he be as God, and man jumped at that. Man made a declaration of independence. Every man since then has done the same. Every man has tried to cut off his life support by declaring his independence from God. I mean, idolatry is like when you've worked and sweated and bled and cried to build some business, to support yourself, support your family, and you've given it everything you've got, and someone comes along who's never done anything and looks at you in the head and says, you didn't build that. That's the kind of insult that idolatry is. And idolatry is irrational from start to finish. I mean, that's Paul's point in Romans chapter 1. Paul says in verse 20 of Romans 1 that they knew there was a God. Things they saw in creation were inexplicable without a God. They knew there was a God, and yet they decided not to acknowledge Him as God. They decided not to worship Him as God. It's like being shown all of the evidence that the earth is round. And say, no, I still believe it's flat. Now, that's what man did. And in making that decision, man did not, in declaring his independence from God, man did not draw closer to the angels
He descended to the level of the animals, both philosophically and practically. If there is no God, man's just an animal, maybe a higher order of animal, but just an animal. If there is no God, practically, men very quickly act like animals. Remember that story of the Lord of the Flies? You know, those cultured English boys crash on that island. And the next thing you know, they are acting like animals, attacking each other. They even kill one of the boys, you know, as part of their rituals. That's pretty much Romans chapter 1. And Egypt was as idolatrous as you can get. The land of Egypt was nothing but idolatry from start to finish. It was once said that you could sooner meet a god in Athens than you could a man. Athens was so full of idols. But take that nationally, and you've got Egypt. Every village had its own god. When the various sections of Egypt started combining, one god would gain the ascendancy until finally when Upper and Lower Egypt got together, Horus, the falcon god, was the supreme deity. They had gods, they had goddesses, they had demigods, they had demons, they had spirits. Everything about Egypt, the whole nation, was a gigantic insult to God. You think our nation's an embarrassment and an insult to God? We're kindergarten compared to what the Egyptian nation knows back there in their idolatry. And in descending to the level of animals, they even made their gods in the image of animals, just like Paul says in Romans chapter 1. If you've ever been up to the Oriental Institute, University of Chicago there, where they've got all of those figures and images that they took out of Egypt back in the 1920s, and you see gods made to look like a crocodile, you see gods that look like a hippo, you see gods that look like snakes, gods that look like bugs, and all of those are meant to represent the supreme being, their deities. When my younger son Steve was in second grade, he was given the assignment, the class was given the assignment one day of drawing a picture of what their dad did. He drew a picture of me sitting in a chair with my feet up on the desk. Now, if he had drawn a picture of me like snake, you know, I can handle, you know, leaning back, feet up on the desk, reading a book. But if he had drawn me looking like a snake, well, that's what the Egyptians had done. And when Pharaoh said, "Who is this God, this Jehovah, that I should let Israel go?" Moses says, "Oh, you don't know who God is." And he enrolled Pharaoh in a 10-part correspondence course. And just like we read in Numbers 33, each of those plagues was an attack upon an Egyptian god, a direct challenge to the gods of Egypt. And how did the gods of Egypt react? They said nothing. They did nothing. They had mouths, but they couldn't speak. They had feet, but they couldn't walk. And finally, under the sheer pressure of the suffering, Pharaoh has a lapse and allows the Israelites to leave. And what God intended in all of the plagues, culminating in what is not in the Hebrew called a plague, the tenth, it's called stroke, the final stroke, the death of the firstborn. What God is trying to do is to reach Egypt. I mean, he started out by just asserting the truth. Jehovah says, "Let my people go." Pharaoh wasn't listening. And so then God has to increase the temperature. Not because he hated the Egyptians. Not because he was bent on destroying them. The plagues were God seeking and trying to save the lost down in Egypt. That was an evangelistic effort. That was a gospel meeting that went on down there. God trying to save that nation from what was coming. Did it work? Not ultimately. Because what Pharaoh demonstrated is that God has given man the power to destroy himself in giving man free will. Man can act independently, and man can act in a way that will destroy himself. But there's something else to be said about who was reached by what happened in Egypt. Look at Hebrews 11, verse 31. By faith, the harlot Rahab did not perish with those who did not believe when she had received the spies with peace. Over in Joshua chapter 2, the spies show up there in Jericho, and somehow they come across this whore by the name of Rahab, and she takes them into her massage parlor, and they start talking. And she tells those spies, you know what? We've heard what your God did down in Egypt. We heard how he dried up the sea. And I'm going to cast my lot with you. I'm going to be on your side. And she and her family were spared. One of the great grandmothers of Christ became a believer because of that Bible study God conducted down in Egypt. The undeniable fact of God. We talk about Israel, the unremarkable faith. And to me, this is an extraordinary thought that we have here in verse 29. You know, all of Hebrews 11 is meant to illustrate Habakkuk 2:4, the just shall live by faith. It's quoted in Hebrews 10:38. And every individual mentioned in Hebrews 11 is an illustration of what God means when he says, the just shall live by faith. And so we start reading, we read about the undaunted faith of Noah building that ark. We read about the unquestioning faith of Abraham going out to a place where he didn't even know where he was going. We read about the courage of a Moses saying to Pharaoh, you don't scare me. We read about the faith of three boys quenching the violence of fire. They didn't know if they'd be burned to a crisp, but they knew where their faith lay, and they were willing to endure the fire. And so we have one heroic example of faith after another. And then we've got verse 29, which is the cowbell and the concert. By faith they passed through the Red Sea. By faith. When you go back to Exodus 14, verses 10 to 12, you know what Israel was doing right before they passed through the Red Sea? They were complaining. They were griping. They were racked with doubt. They were blaming Moses. If you had left us alone, things would be fine. We wouldn't be between this rock and a hard place if you had just left us alone. Fear, doubt, blame, accusation. That's the street where most of us live. I mean, I know those kind of people. I've been those kind of people. Called by God to do something, but not seeing how I and my power can accomplish it. Wondering what in the world God is thinking by asking me to cross the Red Sea. They crossed the sea. You know what they did when they got across? They doubted. They blamed. They accused. They feared. How do they get into a chapter like this? How do you explain this bunch of complaining, griping, moaning Israelites getting mentioned in the same breath with Abel, Enoch, Samuel? Well, I think the answer to that is that not all faith rises to the level of an Abraham's. Obviously not. Not all faith rises to the level of a Moses. The disciples said, we don't have enough faith to do what you're asking. Christ said, oh no, you do. If you've got faith like a grain of mustard seed. Now we're looking at mustard seed faith when we talk about the Israelites. I mean, that is mustard seed faith. Moses finally, after hearing all they have to say to him, goes back to God. In Exodus 14, 15, God says, Moses, what are you doing here? This isn't any time for prayer. You get that group of Israelites and you go forward. And Moses took off. And the Israelites, under stress and duress, followed. They had enough faith to follow. They had enough faith to put one foot in front of the other. And keep going till they got to the other side. And God says, that's justifying faith. We might not call it that, but the God of grace calls it that. The God of mercy calls it that. Got a call a few weeks ago from a lady. She's the age of my kids. I've known her for a long time. She's had a tough life. And her husband right now, they don't live anywhere around here. Her husband is giving every sign of being unfaithful. I mean, he is giving every sign. And you know what she's done to try to get things back to where they were? She has nagged him constantly. She has told him repeatedly how he is failing as a husband, how he is affecting her and her emotions, how he is breaking her heart. She's been giving it to him 24/7. You know what he's done? He's just become entrenched in his behavior. You know what she's done? She's nagged even more. So she called and she was telling me about all of this. And over the phone, I said, let's go to 1 Peter 3. And she turned over there and I had her read verse 1. I said, you know what verse 1 means? Verse 1 means don't nag. Everything within you is saying that's what you need to do to try to bring your husband back. 1 Peter 3:1 says, don't nag. And verse 6 says, don't be afraid. Don't let your fear that God's method of restoring an unbelieving husband, an ungodly husband, by a pure and chaste life, don't be afraid that that won't work. And you revert back to nagging. God's telling you what to do here. You need to go forward and do it. And I'm not saying she's doing it perfectly. Goodness, folks, if it takes perfect faith to go to heaven, we don't have a chance to. But she's trying hard to put one step in front of the other and to keep going. Folks, the only way I know to live life is to go as far in obedience as the Word of God takes us. And when we get to that point, wait for Him to show us the next leg of the journey. And faith keeps taking those steps. Faith keeps going even when we don't understand how it's all going to play out, how it's all going to work. And that's the Israelite faith. I mean, they are at the bottom of the faith hierarchy in Hebrews 11. And I'm so glad they're there because their behavior, their thinking, their reactions more closely parallels mine than Abraham taking that boy to the hills of Moriah to offer him as a sacrifice. I can a lot better relate to Israel than I can to Abraham. Or Moses giving up the position of the mightiest man in the world, the Pharaoh of Egypt. He was in line for that, I think. And turning his back on that and heading out to a wasteland, a wilderness. I can relate to the Israelites better than I can to Moses. And God has them in here with their unremarkable faith to encourage us with whatever spark of faith we've got. Lord, I believe, help thou my unbelief. And then that brings us to the Egyptians. Exodus 51, the song of triumph is that the Lord has thrown the horse and rider into the sea. Again, God's not gloating. This is not a dance on the grave of the Egyptians that he's doing here. This is the kind of Thanksgiving that we might have when a Hitler is overthrown, when a Osama bin Laden is caught. What do we know about this Pharaoh? Just from the biblical text. We don't know his name. May have been searching for centuries to figure out which Pharaoh this was. We don't know which one he was. But we do know that he was merciless because he gave the order that the Israelite slaves were to make bricks without straw. That's like saying, you make an omelet without eggs or you're going to be beaten. We know he was murderous. His immigration policy was infanticide, to kill the male baby Hebrews. We know he was superstitious. You know who's standing around him when Moses walks in with a staff and throws it down and becomes a snake? His sorcerers and his magicians. And for a while, the first couple of plagues, he thought Moses was doing magic tricks because the magicians somehow or other could sort of mimic what Moses was doing. But it got to the point where the magicians went to him and said, listen, this is the real McCoy. This is the finger of God. When God acts in history, his fingerprints are all over it. We know that he had disdain for his nation. He would rather let Berlin be bombed into rubble before he'd surrender. He'd rather let Egypt be devastated by the plagues before he would yell, uncle. Psalms calls him a Leviathan. Ezekiel calls him a great monster. That's the guy we're talking about. God got him in that Bible course. God tried to reach him, but Pharaoh, this is the sad fact of life, proved unreachable. If you've got a child, if you've got a spouse, if you've got a loved one that has been unreachable, listen, you keep hoping for their redemption. You keep hoping for their turn. If they are unreachable, if it's impossible for them to be brought to repentance, God knows that, but you don't, and you keep praying and you keep working to try to turn them and to bring them back. But Pharaoh, even though God knew he was unreachable, kept reaching for him. But it got to the point where God could not ignore his rebellion, his unbelief. And that's because God is holy, and a holy nature cannot ignore sin. God couldn't skip over. He couldn't wink at what Pharaoh was doing. God's nature makes judgment both natural and necessary. And the reason I know judgment is necessary is because of the cross. If there was any way sin could have been dealt with without Calvary, Christ asked for that. If it's possible, let this cup pass. But it wasn't possible. I don't understand it, but judgment is necessary. And it's because God is holy. And you might be thinking, well, there were lots of people in the Bible who did something terrible and that they got away with it. David, look what he did. He got away with it. Listen, if you call losing four sons because of what you did getting away with it, you and I think differently. David lived because somebody else died. And we all live because somebody else died. God's victories are judgments. They are always redemptive. If they can't reach the sinner, they're meant to reach the Rahabs. God is brokenhearted when he has to do what he did at the Red Sea. He's brokenhearted. He takes no delight in it at all. And the last point to make is the point that's stated there in verse 29. The Egyptians attempting to do so were drowned. The Egyptians couldn't go where Israel went. Israel crossed over dry ground. The Egyptians tried to cross over dry ground. They couldn't. They were drowned. Now, why did Israel cross over? Well, it wasn't because they were hard workers. It wasn't because they had suffered for several hundred years as slaves. It wasn't because they were honest. It wasn't because they were good neighbors. Israel passed over. It wasn't because they were exemplary people. I just talked about that, the complaining and griping. They passed over for one reason. They were covered with blood. That's why Israel passed over. They had enough trust in God, enough faith to put the blood out there on the doorpost and lintel. And when God saw the blood, He passed over, and because of their faith in the blood, they passed over. God looked for blood in Egypt, He didn't see it. The Egyptians did not cross over because God saw no blood. Now, I want to tell you something. If God doesn't see blood on you tonight, you can't go to heaven. You can't go where the person sitting next to you is going because of their faith in the blood of Christ. It doesn't matter whatever else that's good can be said about you. If there's no blood on you, you can't go where they're going. And that's the judgment you will bear, just like Pharaoh bore judgment, if you don't have the faith to have the blood applied. I may have told this story here before, but you probably all forgot it. So I'm going to tell it again. It's a true story. In the old state books in Paris that you can still see, they have books with the name of every town in France at the top of the page. And underneath the name, it is a listing of all of the debts that are owed by the citizens of that town. The king wanted to know how much to expect from each village. So they had these books. They were census books. And in one of those books, there's a page that has at the top the name Doremi. And written across the page in red ink are the words, "Free for the maid's sake." Doremi was the home of Joan of Arc, and because of her service to the crown, the king, I think it was Charles, said, "What can I do to show my appreciation, France's appreciation to you?" She says, "Exempt my village from taxes." And I think it was up until the 20th century that that town didn't have to pay any taxes. And when I read that story, I thought about another book that's got the name of all of us in it. And at the top of the page with my name underneath is line after line after line of debts I owe the king, and I can't pay them. But written across the page with my name are the words, "Free for the Son's sake." Forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake hath forgiven you. Those words aren't written because of my exemplary faith. They're written because I put my faith, my trust, in the blood of Jesus Christ. And I did what He asked me to do, to demonstrate that faith by being baptized for the remission of sins. If you're here tonight and there's no blood on you, for goodness sake, before we leave tonight, get it applied. Get it on the doorpost and lintels of your heart by confessing that Jesus is your Lord, repenting of your sins, and being buried in baptism. And when you are, the blood will be applied. If there's any here who need to respond now, we encourage you to come while together we stand and while we sing.